Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast, and thank you for listening. I just want to thank our listeners for listening, because that's why you're here. You know what, Lisa Weir?
What?
It's our 50th episode.
Oh man, we're totally legit now.
If this were an anniversary, we would be showering each other with gold.
I was just going to ask what the gift was.
Yes. golden anniversary. But it's not an anniversary. We've only been doing this for like 4 years. So what is four? I didn't even bother to look up four.
I don't know. One is paper.
It's probably like garbage.
One is paper. And one is five paper, which is wood, weird. I think.
Big letdown on the paper. It's a bad year.
I'll fold you a paper crane.
I'm Dave Etler, and it gives me no small amount of pleasure to say that I'm here with students Lisa Weir. Greg Woods joins us for the first time.
Hello.
Deep Bot.
Hey.
And, of course, Cole Cheney is back with
us. Hello.
And we'll be joined by admission staffer Amy Ahern later. But for now, thank you for coming, guys.
We're happy to be here.
I'm happy to be here as well.
Usually your intros, Dave, are more of on the footnote of the sub. You have this very long literary intro.
Are you disappointed?
Today was just straightforward. Yeah. You know.
Well, I'm in a straightforward kind of mood.
Okay.
but I am curious. I was reading this blog entry by a medical student out there in the universe about what she does to escape the medical school bubble. And I hear often, you know, like M1s especially, they come in and they're like, oh my God, I have so much work to do. It's so hard, you know, and they put their heads down. I never see them again. But what do you guys do to like not be in med school?
For me, that's something that I've really tried to balance over the last couple of years.
And yes, Greg Wood, tell us more.
It is difficult because it's so unlike any other schooling that you've had before. So for me, I came into this having a million interests, all kinds of different things. So one thing that I've tried to do is retain a little bit of that, try to hold on to it and make time for things. Because if you just keep working and keep on pushing through stuff, that's going to be less helpful than if you do take breaks and hold on to the things that you enjoy and that make you you.
That's what I think. Well done. Invited him here just to agree with me.
Yes, man.
What do you do, Cole Cheney?
I play a lot of basketball.
Uh huh. Physical activity.
I do yoga on Wednesdays.
You do?
Where do you do yoga?
I do yoga. I go to the hot house.
Do you have a sweet set of yoga pants?
Oh no, I kind of wear these bike shorts, and then I wear shorts over the bike shorts, so it's like double. You know, just making sure for me.
Double coverage?
Yeah, it's a big deal for a guy.
Making sure for me.
It's really weird, though, because the first year I was more about like this physical activity is taking away from my time to study. And then now I probably do something every day, which is crazy, even though the workload's increased, because it totally clears the head, resets me. I don't feel groggy like a nap, so I'm all about getting out and doing things. And that's just me.
Mr. Iowa Medicine was yesterday. Did anybody see that? Because the reason I bring it up is because the final act.
Oh,
what was his name?
Thomas Pack.
Yes, he did a triathlon act.
That was the second to last.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Ryan
second
Frisbee.
To last one.
Ryan Frisbee.
Oh, Frisbee. Yes,
yeah.
He did a triathlon act, and I have to say he was quite well dressed for the event.
Thomas Pack did a 5 different dance style routine.
Was that not amazing?
With a partner. I would see him. I'd go to the field house. I'd watch him practice. A lot. He's incredible.
Where does he practice at the field house?
He takes one of those dance studio rooms.
Oh, like right by the track?
Yes. He's a very smart, very nice classmate. It was really cool to see him.
I was deeply impressed with all of the Mr. Iowa Medicine. I took some pictures and put them on our Twitter feed. You can go and check those out. And I believe that our Learning Communities Coordinator, Megan McDowell, will be posting videos on our YouTube channel. Shortcode doesn't have a YouTube channel. The College of Medicine YouTube channel. At least some of them, so you can go. If you weren't able to make it yesterday, you can go and enjoy them. They were pretty damn good.
We can swear on this radio show now, Dave?
We can say damn.
Yeah.
We can say damn. Oh, yeah. Hey, we're joined by Amy Ahern from the admissions office because, Cole, our listeners have feelings, questions, thoughts, and beliefs.
I really doubt that.
They do.
Okay.
And they sometimes experience events, happenings, occurrences, and occasions.
I used to think when I was little that when I was at school, the whole world stopped. And then when I got out of school, like then it cars continued to go. So this is kind of the same thing. I find it hard to believe the listeners do things outside.
It's true. They do. Okay. And when they do, we ask them to call us and tell us about them for our segment, Moment of Truth. All they have to do, Cole, is visit theshortcoat.com and click on Tell Us Your Moment of Truth, and they will find at least three ways to talk to us. At least three. And today, we have a listener question from Corey, who sent us an email. Now, Cole.
Yes.
Before I get into Corey's question, I by no means want to discourage people from emailing us, but this is an audio podcast, which means that audio is king. I could read Corey's email, but I think my famous voice is probably too famous, and perhaps our listeners would have associations with the sound of my voice that are unintended, right? So I gratuitously fed Corey's email through a text-to-speech processor so that Amy Ahern could answer his question, which concerns his medical aspirations and medical mission trips. Here we go.
My name is Corey. I am a junior at the University of Iowa. I am always looking to broaden my med school application. Recently, a nonprofit medical group I am in decided we are going to Costa Rica to provide medical relief to children. I have always wanted to do something like this. Besides the overwhelming satisfaction this trip will give me, I would like to know how this trip will benefit my med school application. Initially, I thought experience with medicine outside the US would look great. Lately, I have heard some people say that med schools may think I am overstepping my boundaries, as medicine in other countries does not parallel ours. I am aware trips such as this one are starting to become a mainstream for pre-med students also.
So, I guess his question, Amy Ahern, is, would he actually be overstepping his boundaries?
I feel like a drone is going to fly in and Cole's going to come walking out.
But seriously, I mean, we see, I assume that you do see medical mission trips in admissions, or basically as part of somebody's experience when they come to medical school. Is it helpful?
Yeah, it's a great question that he's raised. And I've just started working in the office recently, but I talked with our director of admissions about this as well when I got ready for the show. And what's interesting is that we are hearing a lot more of these kind of gap year experiences, or I have an opportunity to go do something great. How will it look on my application? And so what's really a couple of things that I want Cole and other people to consider if they are faced with.
Why are we picking on Cole?
No, because he was nice enough to write in.
Okay.
But
Corey.
Oh, gosh, Corey.
He's Cole.
Cole, it's okay. Oh, it's a Friday, everyone.
It's fine.
Friday.
It's fine.
Corey
doesn't mind.
Corey, one thing to think about is that there are a lot of people that need help in the U.S. too. So it's not as if just going abroad is the be-all, end-all way to help people. And there are a lot of people in the U.S. who need medical help in lots of different ways. So one thing to consider, also really important, is to figure out what kind of liability would be going on if you did travel outside of the U.S. I would encourage you to talk with other students when you hear about these opportunities who have gone before to find out what you actually do get to do if you do leave the country and do some helpful work. Committee members, you have to remember their frame of reference when they're reading.
You're talking about the admissions committee, the people who actually review your application to decide whether you're going to get an interview, basically, right?
Yes, okay. Definitely. So those people are, they've been through medical school, they're practicing surgeons and doing all these kinds of great work. And so if they read an application that says, oh, I was 19 years old and I went to a country and I performed surgery, that's not going to go well by any means.
Is that common?
I'm not going to answer that, Dave, okay. But I'm just saying that it's not good if people are overstepping boundaries, is what I'm saying, when they go on some of these trips. So cultural awareness is very, very good. Reflection on the differences between cultures and experiences is very, very good. Being a part of team is very, very good. Claiming to be a superhero would not be very good.
Yeah, I was going to say cultural competency is kind of big in medicine these days. So, I mean, that could be, you know, that could be how to position that trip.
Absolutely. That would be extremely helpful in reviewing an application. So the cultural competency is absolutely something we're looking for. But kind of being that superhero and I saved the people of this country, that is not the kind of thing that we're looking for in an application.
All right.
Yeah, I actually went on one of these medical mission trips. I did a week in Honduras doing a medical brigade, and I did another week doing a public health brigade.
Oh, wow.
So we built, like, latrines and toilets. I literally dug a poop hole 12 feet deep.
There you go.
There you go. Censored myself for you. But yeah, it was interesting. I would highly recommend it to anyone who wants to go. First, they're expensive. I consider them like luxury vacations that help boost your medical school resume, because it's something nice that you can put on your resume. A lot of people have them. And the basic breakdown is, like, when I went to Honduras, you wake up in the morning, you take a three-hour bus ride through, like, very rocky terrain. They don't have roads, so it's hard to sleep. You get there, you're not really going to be doing anything crazy like surgery. You're mostly going to just be handing out vitamins and medicines like Tylenol and ibuprofen that these people don't have. Maybe you'll take some vitals. If you can speak Spanish, you can help take histories. But you bring along a set of doctors with you, and they do that kind of work. And then you come back. You're back by 7. You eat dinner, and then you hit up La Tienda. Ooh. You would be surprised at the price of cerveza on these trips. It's very cheap. You pay Honduras prices, and you're just with a bunch of college kids. So it's really like, it's like a half service trip, half spring break in like a third world country. So they're really fun. And that's the thing they don't tell you, because, you know, it's supposed to be like this mission I'm helping. But they're good, rewarding experiences. And my one advice to anyone who goes to medical, who does this, don't make it the sole focus of your application.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will do these things and then make their essay all about how they went to Honduras and saved all the people. And in my first draft of my medical school essay, I almost made that mistake. And one of my mentors saved me. It's like, dude, you cannot be saying this in your essay. They're going to think you're a clown.
Which turns out to be true.
It is true. But don't let them know that until they let you in. And then, But the way you can talk about it is how you learn about altruism from these things. How you learn about helping people and how helping people makes you feel good. And you're not doing it for them, you're doing it for yourself. That's a nice little spin that I used in my essay that I think worked really well. Yeah, so these mission trips, they're expensive, they're good, they're by no means necessary. I think when you're trying to apply to medical school, you get so caught up in like, oh, this person has this, oh, this person has this. I really don't think the person reading your application is going to be like, well, I'm going to take this person because they went on a medical mission trip. They're much more likely to just judge your character from your essays and your experiences. And do you have clinical experience? And do you know what medicine is going to be like?
Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you said it really well. I would agree with that. And I think that ultimately, if you go on the trip, it's helpful. But what really comes down to it is, what did you learn from that trip and how are you articulating it then? So I think you just nailed it on the head.
Well, while you're here, give us some other tips for the med school applicant. What do you see? What are some common
foils?
She
didn't prepare this.
Consider dentistry.
Yeah. Are there any foils that you normally see that you maybe steer people away from, or things that you see that you go, wow, that was a really great idea or a good way to package it?
That's a really great question. So I'm really focusing more on the interviews because I started 3 weeks before the interviews began. So I'm just starting to review the applications. I'm very new to that part. What I have observed in the interviews that I've seen is the people that can truly calm their nerves as much as possible are doing really well in their interviews. And there's nothing more disappointing to me to, you know, have somebody that's so fabulous and has done all this work on paper, and then they come here and they can't even speak about themselves because they're so nervous, they're shaking, they haven't slept in 3 weeks. All those things just can be really detrimental. And so somebody that can show up, take a deep breath, be as calm and relaxed and as themselves, as genuine to themselves as possible, are really the ones that are standing out right now.
I have a tip.
Beta blockers.
Propranolol.
I take a shot. I have a tip, which is
don't drink.
If you're a dude, consider having your suit tailored.
Yes, of course.
You know what I'm
saying? Cleaned.
And yep. Well, clean, I would assume clean. But
double Windsor on the tie.
Don't assume clean.
I just think that, you know, and I'm no fashion plate. But,
really?
I know. I think our viewers may have this idea from the tone of my voice, you know, or our listeners may have this idea from the tone of my voice or whatever, that I am well put together.
Your cunning wit.
But the truth is, I look like garbage.
Oh, that's not true either.
I'm just kidding.
You smell like it too.
The truth is that I think if you show up in a suit that's tailored to you, I think it's going to give you confidence that you may or may not lack. I don't know. I'm just saying. Get your suit tailored.
Don't be too flashy, though.
Snip the vent.
Oh, in the back.
Snip the vent in the back.
Nice.
I see this a lot.
I think you should do
that's a good call.
Like power poses, too. Have you read the research on doing power poses before you have interviews?
I don't know what that is. Yes, that's supposed to... It gives you more confidence. It reflects on your body language very well.
In the mirror?
Power poses.
You can do them wherever. You don't even have to look at yourself.
What is a power pose?
So,
just show us.
Bodybuilding.
I mean, I know this is an audio podcast.
Where you take up space. So you like put your arms out and your chest out and you're like, power pose. And so, like,
you don't have to say that, but
like the same approach to fighting a bear. Like,
yes.
You
puff up.
Yeah. Versus, you know, like, there's like, I don't know, there's a word for them, but not power poses.
Lame.
Where, you know, you can have poses. Your shoulders rolled in and your hand is kind of by your neck. So don't do that kind of stuff.
All right.
Take up space.
All right.
It does work, they say.
Man, see this? See what we're doing
here?
I like
it. I'm going to incorporate
We're actually being helpful.
So,
morning power
I have one more question, though. So you're on the interviewer's side, correct? That's sort of your focus.
Coordinating the
interview. Coordinating interviews. Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense for the screening process of getting the interview versus the interview itself? I know it's so
you're
hard to get.
You're asking for like secrets or something.
But these are interesting, I think, for people to see. You know, is everyone that walks in that door, are they starting at zero and then the interview starts? Or is there some thought that goes into them already and the interview is just part of the package?
I'll tell you why this is great.
I'm sure it's a holistic approach and that's what everyone's going
to
tell
they
you.
They have to say it, but I
can just save you the buzzword answer. It's a holistic approach.
This look of terror here.
That's the answer.
This is fantastic. I gave Amy one question. I'm like, this is the one you're going to answer. And now she's being like,
you can say, I don't know. That's totally acceptable. I ask the hard hitting questions, though. You know,
that's what we're about.
Yeah. You do, Cole. You do. All right.
In my experience, I'd say just don't disqualify yourself. Don't say anything over the top. Don't be too nervous. As long as you don't disqualify yourself, you give yourself a chance the entire way.
Sure.
And then you just have to hope the admissions monkey picks your name out
Play
of the hat.
Play it safe. In fact, don't open your mouth at all. Don't say anything. Just like sit there and, you know, that way you can't disqualify yourself.
See, that'll disqualify you as someone who can't
conform.
I hadn't considered that.
Conform,
Wait,
everybody.
You bring up a good point, though. Sometimes people, sometimes people try to apologize for things in an interview, and that's something you definitely don't ever want to do. But I think everything that you said.
And you got to answer why medicine. Why medicine is your question. You can spin that into anything you want. You have to have a good answer for why medicine, and it can't be because I want to help people.
No.
Do not answer because I want to help people.
I always wanted to be a doctor. That's the other one that's good.
Yeah. Or because my dad's a doctor.
Yeah.
Dad's
All right. This Money. Set of questions has gone completely off the rails.
That's true, though.
So, I agree.
It's helpful.
But,
it's the first question they ask you at every single interview.
I can't imagine that you're wrong.
Why don't you
want
to be a doctor?
But I want Amy to come back on the show.
Oh, sorry.
Really? Are you sure? I'm not sure you're sure today.
At some point, you know.
You don't have to be sure today.
Corey, thank you for your question.
Yes.
Listeners, if you have something to say, you can call us 347-SHORT-CT and leave us a message, or visit theshortcoat.com and click on Tell Us Your Moment of Truth for some other cool ways to tell us what you want to tell us. The whole process is even mobile friendly, which means you can do it wherever you are, whenever things happen. So,
do we have a Twitter?
We do at theshortcoat.com.
Tweet us questions,
too. At theshortcoat. Shortcoat is our Twitter handle. You can tweet us questions.
People like to do that.
Do they?
Yeah.
I'm so old, I have no idea. But I definitely monitor the Twitter, and so you can do that, and we'll answer your question.
The Twitter.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back on the Shortcoat Podcast, if I can do this. Oh, my God in heaven. I will remove that part. Here we go.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
I'll just plead the fact that I've only been here a couple weeks.
It's crazy here on the podcast today. Welcome back. Cole, did you have something you wanted to tell us?
It's the news.
Ooh, the news. Woo.
All right. So I got the story out of Silicon Valley. I'm sure you've heard of it. Maybe not. I wanted to discuss. Earlier this week, technology giants Facebook and Apple revealed they are going to offer to cover the costs of female employees to freeze eggs. I thought this was a really interesting.
They were going to cover the cost of female employees
to freeze their eggs.
Eggs.
So if you want to forgo childbearing to
keep working,
further your career, you
GTFO.
Can.
What?
Really?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So that's sort of the new ploy, because these companies, you know, they have to use other benefits packages to lure people in. You, I don't know why you can't just keep increasing salary, but they don't. They try to offer other ancillary ways to lure people.
I don't know that I trust a company that pays for me to freeze my eggs.
Well, I don't think they're going to put it in, you know, like Bill Gates' freezer.
You don't have to do it.
I don't care.
If you choose to do it, they'll cover your healthcare provider.
If you want me
to
come work for you, you need to give me like European vacation and maternity leave.
Maternity
not freeze
leave.
My eggs.
Yeah, I was going to say maternity
because
leave.
Because you could put it off, but then you're old when you have kids.
And that's the talking point. Yeah, because people are saying, well, what does this mean for how they view us as employees? Does that mean that family should always come second to the career? Does that mean, you know, what implications does that have to the rights of the employee and how they how they're treated?
It's just an option, though. You don't have to freeze your eggs.
Well, that's
they're not saying yes. If you want to work here, ladies, get in line. We're freezing your eggs. This is just like if you choose to, they will cover it.
But I feel like it's implied. Like, if we're offering you this service, like, maybe, you know, they'll think less of me if I don't want to take that and I want to take time off.
It's a good point.
That's true.
And
there's a hidden curriculum.
Yeah.
And they gave you the option. So when you decide to have kids and not forego it, then they can be like, well, we gave you the option. So now that you have kids and you're not dedicating your entire life to work, we can fire you.
Sure.
Get out of here.
Or they'll offer to freeze your children.
The other thing that this article brings up is that in terms of a pregnancy measure, this is somewhat risky relative to a normal pregnancy.
Sure.
The births are typically a bit more complicated than a regular pregnancy. So the one implication also is, do you really want us to have this more medically unadvisable route to go about? But what about the people who maybe can't conceive at all? Then this is like the most fantastic insurance plan in the world, right? Because it covers you. You're going to have to do IVF.
All IVF?
Okay. Yeah, if you're going to have to do it either way, you find a company that actually does it anyway. So it's sticky. It's a messy stuff.
I know. I see a lot of legal ramifications coming into this.
Well, I have a sort of a related story that I found this week, which is that 10 days ago in Sweden, the first baby has been born from a transplanted womb.
I did hear about that.
Yeah.
So, I read about that.
So mom had something called Mayer-Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome, MRKH syndrome. She was born...
Eponyms.
Yeah. It's awesome. Born without parts... We're going to call it MRK. From now on. Born without part of all of her womb, or vagina, I guess, is also a possibility. Transplanted womb came from a 61-year-old friend of the recipient who had experienced menopause 7 years earlier. Also kind of an interesting component of this story. Baby was born 8 weeks prematurely via C-section due to preeclampsia, but was pretty healthy. Again, complex ethical, legal issues here because, you know, there's rejection possibility, obviously, of the transplanted womb, and rejection during the pregnancy would be, I assume, a real problem for the fetus. Safety of the donor, because it's a pretty... involved procedure, potential for bleeding, infection, all that kind of stuff.
That's why they're doing it in Europe, not America.
I guess so, yeah. The recipient would require ongoing treatment with immunosuppressants. All the usual aspects of having a transplant compounded with the aspects of, you know, hoping to give birth to a healthy child. So there have been 9 of these transplants. This is the first baby born. But 7 of them were successful. 2 of them did not succeed, obviously. And this same surgeon actually is attempting to take a womb from a deceased donor, strip it of its DNA, and then use cells from the recipient to re-inhabit the structure of the womb and of the uterus and create a new organ.
That is circle of life right there.
Right there.
Wow.
Well, this conjures the Brave New World imagery of just uteri hanging in like a meat locker full of babies, right? I mean, isn't that the next logical?
It seems like the next logical step.
That's the next logical extension of this.
That's where it's
guaranteed
going.
To go there.
I feel a little, you know, out testosterone here.
Do you
today.
Really? What would you? Are we handling this improperly?
No, it's fine. It's just an interesting day to have this come up,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Would you prefer?
Why didn't
we came from uteri too, Lisa?
That's true. You.
It's
did.
Not uter you. It's uter us.
Whoa, that was really good.
That was from The Simpsons.
No. Honest. It's fine. It's just an interesting, I think about this in terms of like the long-term thing. So yeah, you know, you have your baby, but then like you have the long-term complications of having an organ transplant. Mm-hmm. That's not necessary for you to live. And I think that's a big, big thing to take on.
But if someone can't conceive a child and And this is not like the first line therapy for someone who can't conceive. This is even if you read the article, which I did on Yahoo Shine, where most of these articles have been found, actually. It was like a last ditch procedure for this woman. And if it's the only way they could have a child and they want it, and they should have the right to choose if they want to have it, I feel like. But
yeah, I mean, just me personally, I think it's a very personal choice in terms of what you want to do versus, you know. There are, I guess, other routes of adoption stuff that wouldn't have the medical consequences. They're not cheap either, though.
Yeah, I'm sure this is.
So, I mean,
this is about $300,000.
Yeah, insurance wouldn't cover this. Insurance isn't going to cover an adoption. So I guess if you're going to shell out the bucks.
Got to choose your own path.
Yeah.
Did you bring us something today?
I did.
Oh.
Oh, the first reported case of a Google Glass addiction.
Oh, I read this. My friend actually wrote this article.
No
Azeem Goryashi, yeah.
Wow, in the Journal of Addictive Behaviors. So
the news article in The Guardian.
Oh, well, I'm reading it.
In the Daily Mail.
It was in the London, in The Guardian.
I actually saw this headline and I thought it was going to be a funny joke. I was like, yes, this will be a great one. And then it's real. It's in a peer-reviewed journal. So this guy is in the Navy and he actually presented for treatment for alcoholism. That he'd been wearing his Google Glass headset 18 hours a day, and he only took it off to sleep and take a shower. And so when you go into a psych unit or any sort of, like, rehab program, they take away all your electronics, typically. And so they took away his Google Glass, and so initially they thought the withdrawal symptoms were from alcohol, but then they're like, oh, maybe these are actually from the Google Glass withdrawal. And so he had this weird thing where the therapist would ask him a question, and he'd, like, put his finger up by his eye, like he was turning on his Google Glass to get the answer, and he couldn't come up with the answer and stuff. And he had some short-term memory loss without the Google Glass, it was appeared, and funny things like that. So,
okay.
But after 35 days of residential treatment,
I'm trying to relate.
He appears to be better now.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm trying to relate this to my life because it is true that I remember no phone numbers anymore.
How many email checks in a 24-hour period make you an addict?
I don't know, but I'm not addicted to email.
It'd have to get in the way of other things.
This is a very interesting
like driving
topic.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean,
that would be a roadblock.
Addiction itself is kind of a, you know, some people use the behavioral version of addiction, which would be, you know, email, Google Glass. Other people use the very strict physiological version, which in which case you couldn't be addicted to email. It'd be more like a compulsion.
I find it interesting that his withdrawal symptoms were indistinguishable from those of alcohol withdrawal.
It is very interesting. But I mean, a lot of the alcohol, you get the anxiety and stuff. And so, I mean, I don't know. Think about if you forget your phone at home. Like, I get really anxious. I'm like, crap, I have my phone at home.
I just get annoyed at myself, but yeah.
Well,
you're from a different generation, Dave.
There are things I do.
This is going to play into medicine, though, because there are already UC Santa Barbara, maybe, has students training with the Google Glass.
Yeah.
And so physicians are known to work long hours, and we'll be wearing these glasses, maybe, for a long day. I mean, it could be very real for a lot of us.
Have that kind of like personality.
Probably shouldn't wear Google Glass to your med school interview, by the way.
Yes,
bring that another, back around. Don't do that.
Hang on, let me let me get the answer to that question.
Dave's pointing at his eye. We have to narrate. Dave is pointing at his eye.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Here's a interesting piece on breast cancer awareness campaigns. So they become very funny. Right? So like Save the Tatas is one that's very, some would say, glib. And so the question has now been presented. Do these campaigns trivialize the overall seriousness of the disease?
Who presented this question?
This was actually someone who wrote in to the Huffington Post.
Oh, okay. And that's where I get most of my news.
Yeah.
Not Yahoo Shine?
It's true, no.
Yeah, so the question was, though, by trivializing these diseases, you know, do people kind of laugh off something very serious, such as breast cancer? And the counter-argument is that, well, by making people laugh, they pay attention to it. Breast cancer's gotten a ton of money, a ton of funding. I think it's probably one of the most supported cancers at this point for
research.
I'm going
to go with make people laugh here. My gut response is to this idea is that way better to make people laugh, because if you're serious... If you're like, I mean, it's a serious illness, you know, like, let's be clear. It's
life-threatening
illness. But people who are too serious about things are annoying.
Well, this person is too serious.
Zero reaction to that.
Yeah. The question's interesting, though, of
Well, my rant on this is that the NFL uses breast cancer as a cover to raise a bunch of money and sell a lot of pink jerseys. Because I've looked at the numbers on this, and they make huge profit off the pink jerseys. And
they don't donate?
They do, but they don't donate all the proceeds.
Sure. Really?
Yeah. So it's a huge cover up.
This is one of my soapbox issues.
And now I'm going to be suspended from the podcast for 3 weeks.
No. You're good.
No, really. I mean, if you're going to support breast cancer, there are probably better ways to do it than buying a pink NFL jersey or a yogurt with a pink lid. I mean, if you're going to buy the yogurt anyway, fine, but if you're going to put all that money to an NFL jersey, you'd probably be better off just donating it directly, mm-hmm. where they get 100% of the things instead of an unknown amount.
And you know, there are ways to, you know, check how much of your money goes, although I don't know
how
easy it is to check and say, you know, like the NFL, how much of that money went to
the... just have to spend like 2 or 3 hours at 3 a.m. on the internet. Yeah.
If you donate to charities, though, a lot of times it's more transparent. You can look and see, okay, of this, you know, the money I'm giving to this particular charity, how much of that is going to, this particular cause, which is a useful thing to know. Whereas if you're dealing with a company, they have no, you know, they have no incentive to give that information, or less incentive. All right. Very good.
Any other news stories?
I do.
All right.
I have this story about a woman's 2,400-mile fugue state journey this past September.
Disassociative fugue?
She did.
This is a thing?
Cynthia Adams is 52 years old. She's been having some memory and cognitive problems over the past few years. She went to an appointment at her psychologist and then disappeared. Her family searched frantically, of course, but meanwhile, she decided to go pick up her 3 best friends from childhood and take them to Florida, where she lived when she was a kid. Now, this is all in her mind. Mm-hmm. She didn't actually... go.
Sounds like a good movie idea.
I know, like it's a road trip movie. But when she arrived, when she arrived in it should be a road trip movie. When she arrived in Clara, Mississippi, where her father had once been a minister, workers and patrons at a local grocery store helped her find one of those childhood friends. The friend welcomed her in and figured out what was wrong, and eventually consulted Facebook and found a missing persons page for this person. And I think what's interesting about this story was that if you read this, and of course, as usual, I'll post the link to the story. But what's interesting about the story is all through this 2,400-mile journey, people were like helping her. People like truckers would like pull into the rest stop with her and be like, "Oh, hi, what you doing?" And she'd be like, "I'm off to find my childhood friends." And they would help her be safe and watch her and . And I think everybody, it sounds to me from reading the story that everybody kind of knew that there was something amiss.
Oh, and they were just
protecting her.
That would be a movie right there.
But they were like helping her. They were like, okay, well, the truckers would be like, she's with us.
Enabling her.
You know, yeah, maybe. Okay. You could say that. But it was this grocery store in Mississippi that helped her really come to the end of her journey. All of this... getting her help and figuring out what was wrong took some persuasion and acting chops, because Adams wasn't sort of quite herself. Adams says, "They must have all known that my cheese slid off the cracker because they played it to the hilt." So I think
I have no idea what that means.
I think eventually
sounds like some 1930s.
It is
expression.
It's a great quote
that doesn't translate anymore.
That's why I put it in here. The cheese slid off her cracker.
I gotta remember that. It's pretty good.
Eventually she came to, and it's an amazing story. Go to the website.
These are like those stories when those dogs go on vacation and get lost, and then they somehow walk across 3 states and end up at the, I don't even...
And you know what? That was exactly a great movie called Homeward Bound.
Yeah.
I saw an article about that movie. Well, it was an article and it was 10 dogs that are definitely dead now, and that movie was on it. That's all I can think of. Every time I hear that movie now, I'm like, oh, those dogs are dead.
Mm-hmm. They live in our hearts.
Yes.
They
do.
Bye.
I gotta go.
Deep's gotta go.
All right, we got a new story over here.
Yes. So, first off, it's pretty often we hear about miracle cancer cures and things. The websites that you read these are not always the most reputable, though.
Yes, we've discussed this many times.
Yes.
On the podcast, because mainstream media is a terrible way to get your science news.
Yeah.
But that's what we do here.
Yes. So I pose the question to you, is this actually legitimate or not? We found, scientists found in far north Queensland a couple weeks back, a berry that they think holds more promise than what we've seen in a lot of other cancer treatments.
Is this the acai berry?
No, it is not. Oh. This is actually a berry from the blushwood tree, and they did some painstaking process to isolate a little chemical in it, and they don't know what the chemical does, but they do know that if they apply it to head and neck cancers in a lot of animal trials, and they're going to start on human trials pretty soon, that it actually does decrease the cancer by 75% of cases, and some of the tumors that were there for a long time have disappeared and not come back at all. Of course, though, this bush that has this berry is not just like out in somebody's yard. It's deep in a forest, only living on a cliff, and it's very picky where it likes to grow, and there aren't that many of them. So, of course, it just kind of figures that if this is legitimate, we're going to have to go through all kinds of stuff to get it. But
extremely selfish of nature
to do that.
Well, it's like she's taunting us.
It wants to make it into a great journey, of course. If you have cancer, you have to have a relative that goes on this great journey to find the mysterious berry to save
your
life.
If we could combine...
So you can have a good movie about it.
And the dog is there.
Yes. One of Deep's movies. That works. So the way that this works, they're pretty sure. And this was a legitimate website. There are some journals on this. No, this was...
I love how we have to keep qualifying.
I have to keep reiterating
this.
All right. It first came out on one of the local stations down in Australia, but since then it's grown quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It cuts off the blood supply, it appears. It takes effect very quickly, for another thing. The next day, they say, in a lot of cases, the tumor's just black, and then it just kind of falls off.
Whoa.
I don't know if this is entirely true, but there are pictures to go along with it showing before and after of cancers that have received this treatment. There's a picture of the berry as well, and then a scientist holding it between his fingers, which I'm sure adds legitimacy in way. Don't know.
Why can we not synthesize this?
They are, compound. Yes. The thing is, they don't know what it does, so they never thought to really look for it or test it on anything. So now that they do have it to where they've isolated it, which is apparently a difficult process, I would assume it's just as easy then to synthesize it as opposed to trying to squeeze it out of these berries and have to have Lucille Ball stomp on them or something like that. Because it's
pretty standard
it's
cancer
difficult.
Treatment.
Yeah, that's, well, maybe that's the missing link that we've overlooked. But I don't know. They say it's not effective against metastatic cancers or a lot of other cancers below the head and neck. But for melanomas and things above, they think it holds promise. So keep that on the radar.
I love this idea of like you apply it and then the tumor just sort of turns black and falls off.
That's yeah.
Nice. Now, Greg, you've really been promoting this. I'd like to know if there's any conflict of interest involved here.
you know, I am a grower. I do grow a lot of plants.
He has a mountainside in Australia that he...
I did meet an Australian tree a few weeks back, which was very exciting. But no, I'm afraid not.
All right. Very good.
I have an aside.
Yeah.
Is it the acai berry or the acai berry?
I've heard acai. Okay. But I don't.
Get out. You're totally blowing my mind.
Acai.
I don't acai? Know.
The little thing on the bottom of the sea implies that it is.
I don't acai. Think I've ever seen or noticed the little sea bottom of the sea.
I've heard it pronounced several ways. I assume the lazy would just say acai, but so that's how I'm going for it.
You have pegged me properly.
I was told catechus, and it was caduceus here at the University of Iowa.
Catechus.
Oh. I was told that by multiple people. And I adopted it, so I'm equally as guilty.
They were making. They were looking to make you look like a chump,
and I did word at all because I don't know what it is.
The what? Caduceus?
Yeah,
it's the staff.
Well, no, I mean I know what it is. I just didn't know how to say it, so I just never said it.
Yeah. No, that's my usual. That's my usual approach. Yeah. Well, that was amazing. The acai. I see. I learned about the acai berry, and I also learned this week about alpha gal. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right either, but it is a sugar in red meat and in the Lone Star tick, but not in people. And this is relevant because when the tick bites the person, they put a little of that alpha gal sugar into the bloodstream, and the person then develops antibodies. Which, when they eat red meat, which also has that sugar in it, they have an allergic reaction. So you can become allergic to red meat.
It'd be terrible.
This is kind of especially a problem in Long Island, an area with many ticks. One allergy specialist there has seen 200 cases over the last 3 years of this thing. And so, anyway, I thought that was interesting. I had I didn't.
Harkening back to our last episode, red meat, does that mean humid would have
I was
alpha
say,
gal in it?
Yeah, I guess if you were, I don't know. You're,
I would, then I would when, have to think so.
I yeah. mean,
but we do
if,
have
if they make such general meat, statements right. as red meat has it, then yeah.
I mean, they only called out. They only called out for the purpose of the news story. They only called
would
out. You
be
know,
allergic
like pork
to
and
yourself. Then pork is not a red.
That's what
yes,
they say.
It is.
Well, it has alpha gal.
Pork's a white meat.
Yeah. Pork. The other white meat.
Pork is,
come on, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely red. Don't start with me.
Oh, boy.
Hey, I grew up on a farm. It's the other white meat.
to get to the question of would we be allergic to ourselves?
I mean, if we have alpha gal, but maybe it only
no. I think the point is no. I think the point is that we don't have alpha gal, even though we
so
have.
So we're
red
not
meat.
A red meat.
We're not a red meat, at least in terms of alpha gal. We're not a red meat.
Is it mitochondria? I feel like that's someone told me that once.
I believe it's mitochondria.
Is that what makes you though a red meat versus a non-red meat?
But doesn't everything has mitochondria?
But like the number, I told this is I'm pulling
straws here.
You're
talking about fast twitch versus slow twitch and how much?
And does this make a fiber red versus non-red?
I don't
or is
know
it pigment?
What defines
I think
red.
There should just be somebody that looks
Lichen?
At it after you cut it up and goes, yeah, it looks red.
That's just
red.
That guy.
Yep, yep.
The red
we'll
meat
call
guy.
It. I'll volunteer if nobody wants to.
I have this weird feeling that I think we're not going to see it in our lifetimes, but red meat is going to slowly, like we've been told it's has a lot of risk carried with it, the health implications.
Mad cow
now
disease.
Now there's things with ticks going on.
Prions.
I feel like it's...
Or is it prions?
It's like the NFL where you can't
that's
imagine
legitimate.
It not being there, but slowly, like the more it takes a little more abuse every year and people sort of realize more and more that there's bad things associated with it, yeah. I think it's going to... It'll be weird. I could just see like our kids being like, can you imagine they ate cows? Isn't that...
Disgusting.
Yeah. And they play like this game where you like smash your heads into each other on a football field. Like there's all these things that are going to... It just, it's a ways off, but I see red meat. That's my prediction, my Nostradamus. All right, I got one more really quick.
Go for it.
So I hate talking about Ebola. I hate all these stories, but...
Wow, it's getting harder and harder not to talk about it.
Well, that's the thing. So I found this awesome overlapping pie graph in USA Today, which is
Camembert
the...
Camembert graph?
Yeah.
Called in
we are
in
not
France.
French.
Yeah. What do we call them again?
In France, they call them Camembert.
What?
Like
why?
The cheese.
Oh.
Cheese round.
Wheel. Sure.
Anyway, that was my fun fact for today.
So here's my cheese graph. essentially, what you need to know, though, is the thought of, do you have influenza? Do you have Ebola? Or maybe of both, and then you're really in trouble. Okay, so here's the deal. You have fever, you have sore throat, you have headache, and you have fatigue. Which do you guys think you could have?
I haven't had my coffee in the morning.
The flu.
The flu,
okay.
I would go flu on that one.
So with this, if it's under 8 days, it could be either. Okay, so that's the big distinguishing point. So if you have these acute syndromes, you could have either. Now, where we start to draw the line is after 8 to 12 days, and these persist. Now we're getting a little more...
When does the bruising in that begin?
That so here's where, after these 8 to 12 days, we also see secondary Ebola problems. This is when we get the high fever, significantly higher than just a flu. We get chest pain, which is very unique to this, okay? Loss of appetite, red eyes, and blood in stool. So it's a weird thing, but all of a sudden you sort of, if you get sick kind of on regular, I get the flu all the time. And so
constantly.
I like all winter I'll have these sort of like pharyngitis flu going on, but you'll start to wonder. But that chest pain they said is the one that really is a big red flag. That's a very weird sign to have relative to these other symptoms.
So when you have the flu and an anxiety attack at the same time, you're gonna be hurting pretty bad there. You're gonna be thinking that
whatever you don't go to WebMD and put in your symptoms.
No.
My biggest concern with this Ebola thing is, so they've quarantined this nurse's dog. Like, what if her dog gets Ebola? Like, I'm really concerned about dogs and Ebola.
Oh, you're like those, it Spanish or French people that freaked out?
I know, they put the Spanish nurse's dog down.
I know.
Oh, they did? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they don't even know if dogs can get Ebola from humans.
Because last I heard, the one that's quarantined in Texas.
Yeah, that one's just quarantined,
okay,
it's fine.
So that one's fine, that's
but
not the one they
one
put down. You're talking about,
last
oh, okay,
week that
gotcha.
They put down.
Yep.
Yeah. That's my concern.
Let's put more people at risk.
But
for,
we don't.
For the sake
mean,
of the dog.
Just quarantine it.
Hey, the dog. They said, and this is a paraphrase of a direct quote. They said it is resting comfortably with toys and a blanket.
Oh no, I'm referring to the Spanish dog.
Well, it's resting a bit more comfortably.
oh no!
All right. You got that one.
All right. I'm going to call this to a halt. But thank you guys
Good
so
call.
Much. Short Code Podcast is brought to you by a generous donation from the Writing and Humanities Program, as well as the College of Medicine's medical student government. Lisa, again, I went to print out, I left to print out the thing, and I printed it out.
Oh, you
I didn't bring it?
Well, last week I said thank you to student government. So this week, thank you, Writing and Humanities Program.
There you go. And we're a proud member of the Vocalist Podcast Network. Please go to our website at the vocalistpodcastnetwork.com or .wix.com. I don't know. Just go to our theshortcode.com and look it up. All right? For God's sake. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next time.